Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies. I'm your host, Katie McEwen. On today's show, I'm speaking with Stacey Alimo, the author of Exposed, Environmental Politics and Pleasures in Post-Human Times, which was published last year by the University of Minnesota Press. Exposed is a series of essays that collectively argue for a new ethics of living in the Anthropocene. And though it bridges an impressive scope of both topics and theory, it accessibly and very enjoyably calls us to rethink what it means to be human. Combining film, fiction, poetry, scientific writing, art, and activism, Alimo explores the relationship between pleasure and environmental politics through both human and non-human agency and subjectivities. Though often playful, this book has serious implications for how we think about the world and how we live in it. So I want to talk through the book in the specific chapters, because each one really does kind of act as a standalone essay, even though this theme of exposed and exposure runs through them. So in the first chapter, you ask if it would be possible to redesign the domestic with an ethics of inhabiting such that the domestic does not domesticate and the walls do not disconnect. I think this is a really powerful way of thinking about a new ethics of habitation, of dwelling. So what do you mean? What do you mean by that? And what would it look like in practice?
Well, the opposite of what I'm thinking about is the kind of standard sterility and lifelessness, with this emphasis on cleanliness and propriety and borders, that is connected with classism and racism and a real post 9/11 bunker mentality. So I think that, you know, ideally I can envision all homes, apartments, communities, cities being seen as multi-species habitats. So if you start off with the sense that the world, even with human inhabitation, is actually multi-species or could be a rich multi-species habitat, then architecture and planning and especially landscaping can all work around that. So if you start with the needs of various plant and animal species, even if it's only birds, butterflies, insects, reptiles, hopefully maybe some other exciting things like coyotes, whatever could inhabit but also migrate through the space, all of those things need to be taken into account. And I envision something like Lynn Hull's beautiful raptor roofs, where she considers what would aesthetically appeal to the raptor, and thinking about this kind of both in terms of needs but also almost as an aesthetic that's multi-species. But the joy here is this sense of openness to, and this is where the exposure would come in this chapter, I suppose, this kind of openness to the beauty, the pleasure, the liveliness, and the surprise of inhabiting a world with multiple species, not just these pristine, dead, sterile, demarcated zones. I didn't say in practice really what that would look like, but in, you know, in my own yard, I practice this as much as I can. I build little habitats for the lizards and some of the insects, and I plant things for the butterflies and the birds. And I really love that. Even though I live in the city, there's a lot of wildlife that comes into my yard.
And so that relates to the idea of multi-species pleasure. And in the next chapter, which I think is probably my favorite chapter of the book, you speak about queer animals and non-human sexual diversity. It's also a very playful chapter, which is that despite the seriousness of many of the concepts and ideas and experiences that you're taking on in this book, there is a very playful element to it. And this chapter really merges that idea of playfulness and pleasure. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a bit about how thinking about queer animals, as you do in this chapter, could lead to a queer environmentalism.
Well, I do think that, especially in this very bleak time of this sixth great extinction and climate change and the acceleration of assaults upon all sorts of ecologies and environments, that people who are deeply committed to environmentalism do need to have some kind of pleasure, because otherwise it's just so bleak. So fostering that kind of pleasure is something that has been talked about by environmentalists. Andrew Ross spoke about this. Kate Sandilands has spoken about this, and other people, Dan Philippon. I have to say that I'm really happy that a Greek queer environmental activist is translating this chapter into Greek for an activist zine that comes out of Athens. So he must see some kind of some sense that this does have some kind of political resonance. So I'm happy about that. So because of the historical association of queer with unnatural, queer cultural theory has not really been interested in nature, and part of this has to do too with all of the divides with post-structuralism and discursive, the sense of social construction in which everything relevant to cultural criticism happens within a sphere of nature, language, discourse, within culture, language, discourse, and the anything in nature or non-human is relegated to this kind of universe of irrelevance. So I think anything that subverts or erodes this kind of nature-culture divide is important. And I think that contemplating the sexual diversity of non-humans, who are so much more fabulously queer than humans, can help to do that. Because instead of seeing nature as this stable, heteronormative background to a culture that is much more exciting, you can erode that kind of chasm there, that boundary, and see all sorts of sites of a multitude of animal cultures that are rich with queer practices. So then the natural world then becomes a place that is not hostile and not heteronormative. So I'm hoping that this realization that nature is not so straight as it has been portrayed, it's not this kind of realm of heteronormativity, would help to encourage the flourishing of all kinds of environmentalisms that are queer, and queer politics that also does ally itself with environmentalism.
And beyond non-human sexual diversity, another facet of intimacy, let's say, that you speak about in the book, is the role of nakedness in protest. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about nakedness in environmental protest, and then also its relationship to physical places.
Yeah, I mean, those chapters are probably the most literal form of exposure, just because people are taking off their clothes for these protests. I got really interested in them and interested in whether there's a way of thinking about them that beyond the kind of obvious. And they do seem to literally embody this sense of how the flesh is intermeshed with place. And they seem to me a kind of a sort of undoing of the humanist human, because without the clothing, when these bodies are sort of, as they often are in laid out onto particular landscapes, spelling out words. There's a sense of the physicality of the body expressing this real interconnection with the place, with the planet, with the ecosystems. And it, to me, it seems like a kind of critique of the notion of the public sphere as only about political discourse or something mediated only electronically, even though these images are mediated electronically, that for environmentalism and for animal rights protests, it seems particularly important to have the protest be about the fact that humans are literally enmeshed and substantially interconnected with the material realm and with places, and so that environmentalism doesn't just seem like one among many human ideas, that there's something there that's that expands what the realm of the political would be.
Another important aspect or a theme that you talk about in the book is insurgent vulnerabilities. And you specifically use this term in relation to carbon-heavy masculinities, that somehow insurgent vulnerability can be an antidote or a response to carbon-heavy masculinities. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, I almost wish I hadn't written that chapter, because now, my God, with Donald Trump as president, it just becomes every day is an example of carbon heavy masculinities. Every day in the news, there's another example of this, which is just so frightening to witness. I'll start with the term carbon heavy masculinity. So I take that back to Susan Jeffords' early work on masculinity as hard bodies, the hypermasculinity of that, and also connect it with Bonnie Mann's idea of the militarized masculine aesthetic. And of course, in Texas, you see this all the time, because you see these gigantic trucks with sort of militarized paraphernalia all around them, spikes coming out of the wheels. It looks like it's out of, as my colleague Tim Richardson said, it looks like, you know, we're living in Mad Max here. It's crazy. There's a real sense of being armored, impermeable, aggressive, and this fantasy of that you're protected, you're able to protect yourself from the outside and actually dominate everything on the outside. So the opposite of that, you know, I didn't want to make the opposite of that be this kind of openness as only vulnerability, but instead a real feminist sense of occupying as an aesthetic or as an ethics, also aesthetics, I suppose, and a politics where you're occupying vulnerability, you have a kind of intentionality there, which makes it an insurgent vulnerability. So it's you're occupying it as a political act, a kind of radical openness that shows this interconnection between people, places, and non-human life, and the sense of being exposed. So practicing exposure in a political way does not mean being simply vulnerable or simply sort of victimized by that, but expressing it against a kind of carbon heavy masculinity, which to me is a complete delusion. It's a very dangerous delusion, an aggressive delusion of impermeability. So occupying permeability in an insurgent way to me is a kind of counter politics then.
So, Stacey, I want to move on to the next two chapters, the last two substantive chapters of the book, which are specifically about aquatic materialism. And the first one discusses ocean conservation and the aquatic origins of humans, and it asks this very important question, which is, to what extent can transcorporeality extend through the seas? And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that question and where it comes from and, if possible, the answer to it.
So I was trying to imagine a kind of test case for transcorporeality and whether the sense of being materially intermeshed with the world and with ecosystems and creatures could extend far beyond the place where most of us find ourselves, which is certainly not in the middle of the sea. So what I started with, though, in this chapter was I started with the way in which many scientists and conservationists who try to drum up some kind of support for ocean ecologies start with this idea that the human, that human origins are from the sea. So the evolutionary origins of the humans are in aquatic life, in sea life, and an aquatic ancestor. And of course, that goes all the way back to Darwin, the hermaphroditic creature that Darwin talks about, which is great for queer ecologies. But what I found is some of the science writers, actually scientists, who talk about this end up having the human as the end point. So that's the familiar story of the human as the evolutionary end point. So there are all of these, creatures, these fishy creatures within us, supposedly, a whole aquarium. We're teeming like an aquarium of fishes, and then it all culminates in the human, and then the ocean becomes this kind of giant apothecary that is just about improving the human lives. And of course, that is not a very useful vision for any kind of environmentalism or post-humanism. So I think that what's more important is to think about the various ways in which humans are interconnected with ocean ecologies now, both in terms of risk to humans, but then also the way in which our daily practices affect ocean ecology. So the two ways where this comes out most explicitly, of course, obviously, the first would be the consumption of seafood. So anyone who eats seafood is connected in a transcorporeal way to ocean ecologies, because that seafood is riddled with mercury, maybe dioxins, microplastics, and other things, maybe radiation. And so the consumption of seafood links the human health to the health of the seas. But the other side would be something like, even if you don't eat seafood, daily use of plastic is affecting the oceans. So I've been, you know, as far as transcorporeality goes, I'm really interested in how daily life, which seems very banal, very benign, can actually, at the scale at which, you know, you put everybody together, creates this other scale. So you do some kind of tiny thing like throw away a plastic bottle cap, and then that plastic bottle cap ends up killing all of these birds that eat it, or fish who eat it. And so the sense of the embodied sense of the things around us that we use in our everyday life having this enormous impact, and how you think about that scale and what that means for ethics and politics, and then how you trace those interacting material agencies is something I'm really interested in. And I'm really happy to see the creative and quite compelling artistry and activism with, say, the Plastic Pollution Coalition videos that are really funny, and something like Pam Longobardi's work, where she's working on ocean plastic. She's doing all sorts of exciting work in that area. And I think that the scientists, the activists, the artists, the theorists, we're all sort of working on similar issues, which is how to think about the agencies and the implications of these seemingly banal and benign acts that have profound effects on ocean ecologies.
So the activist projects that you describe in the book clearly show the need for more careful thought regarding the ethics of living as humans in the Anthropocene. But you also specifically discuss some of the problems of the concept of the Anthropocene and how it's used. Can you tell me what some of those problems are, and what are some ways that we could rethink this concept or this age of the Anthropocene?
When I was asked to speak at the Anthropocene Feminisms Conference, that was really the first time I started researching that topic and that term. And, of course, it proliferated. It spread everywhere so quickly. And the popular culture renditions of it were depicted in terms, visually depicted, all the same way. So basically, the way to get a handle on the scale, the time scale of the Anthropocene, seemed to be to scale back out into space and look at the Earth from either outer space or at least from up in the sky somewhere. Now that scaling back, I mean, it performs an obvious function, and it does show the extent to which humans have changed, to have altered the planet, at least in its sort of visible and invisible ways, like in terms of the photographs of the lights that are shown on one Anthropocene website, or of course all of the buildings and highways and things like in the Bertinsky film. But there's two problems with that visual depiction. One, you cannot see any other creatures. It's a creatureless dead world. So there's no sense of non-humans and migration routes, either whale migration routes or bird migration routes. So even though you're seeing from this distance, you're only mapping human impact, and there's almost no discussion of other creatures, which is very eerie. But the other thing that I'm interested in is how that perspective, and I draw on Donna Haraway's important piece, Situated Knowledges, for this, how that perspective is this kind of God trick where it's transcendent and it places the human knower far away from the scene, out in space. And then, again, it is another way, I think, of feeling as if we have power and control because we have this transcendent knowledge that removes us, and we are in this free-floating position where we're disembodied again. And I think that the sense of the Anthropocene has to be at a scale where humans can act and where we are connected. So with transcorporeality, the idea that all of these or the sense of exposure in terms of toxins, you can think of your own flesh already being a kind of Anthropocene flesh, because our bodies already have all of these xenobiotic chemicals in them. We're not separate from this strange world that we have ended up altering or creating or manufacturing by accident. And so the sense of agency has to be more complicated. It can't just be this sort of free-floating human and what we have done to the planet. And so in my critique of Dipesh Chakrabarty's work, I make similar arguments as I do with the visual depictions, because he talks about the human as a kind of abstract force. So what is the Anthropos in the Anthropocene? The human is this kind of abstraction, and again, we're sort of removed from the scene and disembodied. And I think that's not helpful. I don't see a way of inhabiting that sense of what we are in any way that is useful.
So tell me then about the final chapter of the book, which is called Your Shell on Acid, which is a great title. Tell me what it means. What does my shell on acid mean, and why is it important for us to contemplate our shells on acid?
So I was looking for other ways of thinking about the Anthropocene, and because my work now is going to focus on the ocean, the last third of this book does focus on the ocean quite a bit. And so one thing that's often left out of the Anthropocene is the ocean. And a lot of it is the Anthropocene images that are available focus mainly on terrestrial formations. So one image that was circulating that I thought was quite compelling was an image of a pteropod that was dissolving because of acidification. And some of those images were really beautifully done, quite stark and elegant. And there's no creature within the pteropod as it's shown. It's just this beautiful, delicate shell. In the videos, it's spinning around as it dissolves. And I was thinking about that as a kind of aesthetic enticement to lure us into contemplating the possible extent of ocean acidification and ocean ecologies, and the way in which the Anthropocene for the sea, but then also more broadly in terms of the sixth great extinction, could be thought as this kind of dissolve, as creatures dissolving, and the shell asks us to sort of project ourselves into that, the aesthetics and this kind of psychedelic sense of the spiral, you know, the sort of mind-altering spiral that you might find on some kind of druggy poster or something for hallucinogens, that can connect here. And I use Richard Doyle to help with that, with his concept of the ecodelic. But I'm looking for figurations that help us think about something that's very difficult to contemplate, because acidification is just this slight shift in the alkalinity of the ocean. And in order to have any kind of power as to provoke environmental concern and to extend environmental concern to the deep seas, we need figurations to think with, and we probably need some things that are a little bit enticing, whether because they're sort of mind-altering and psychedelic, or whether they're aesthetic, or something to make that kind of connection with these ocean ecologies that we're not at all connected with in our daily lives.
So tell me then about the notion of dwelling in the dissolve. Accompanying the idea of your shell on acid is this idea that we are all then dwelling in the dissolve, as our shell kind of, or as the shell evaporates, as it succumbs to acidification. What are some ways that we can then stay present with the environmental issues that we are facing and not be overwhelmed by them, which I think is connected to that notion of dwelling in the dissolve?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can say much more than I just did about that. And it's, in terms of exposure, of course, it's a kind of extreme test case of exposure to imagine oneself dwelling in this dissolve. But maybe, you know, maybe the dissolve is important too, because it can link, it can be sort of the opposite of the commodified consumerism in which everything is a separate object, and that these objects are there for human use, for human utility. And this sense of thinking through the extinction in the sixth great extinction, the extinction of many creatures, and then specifically ocean acidification and the sense of the ocean as a liquid, a watery world rather than a solid world, can keep maybe enticing us to think about these long, vast interconnections and realms of causation and effect and the kind of ethics of exposure that extends. So, you know, again, to go back to the first chapter, that's sort of the opposite of walling yourself off in your apartment or house as this very controlled space where it is only about the human and it's all about separation. So capitalism and the commodification of goods are all about these separate entities that the human uses or consumes versus, to go again back to the sort of to link the first chapter to the last chapter, this sense of being immersed and enmeshed in multi-species material agencies, liveliness, even though we're talking about death with the dissolve, there's still a sense of biological processes happening, and that the world is not just a collection of objects for our use or entertainment value, but instead there is this material world of ecosystems and things living, things dying, creatures living and dying, ecosystems working or failing or being assaulted, that, you know, the more that we think that we're enmeshed within that, that we're connected with that, I mean, I think that that's the basis of environmentalism, environmental consciousness, and I think that, you know, the way in which our world is an Anthropocene world, in which things are so humanly, you know, most people live in such humanly designed, manufactured, and altered spaces where, you know, the only non-humans can be rats or cockroaches or something, that's a huge barrier to even caring about any kind of broader environmental question.
You mentioned that you're now working on a project specifically about the ocean. Can you tell me more about that project? What are you working on?
So that project does begin with this question of, you know, how is it possible to entice people to care about deep sea creatures? So it starts with William Beebe's descents in the 30s, and he was a scientist and explorer, but he was also a popularizer, and he wrote books, and then he also had this amazing artist, Els Bostelman, who painted these surreal depictions of the creatures and the bathysphere dives. I'm interested in that, and I'm very interested in the senses of marine life and the way in which the senses of marine life has incorporated so much of the aesthetic into what they do. So they have art projects, they have coffee table books, they have these beautifully produced and highly stylized photographs and videos. And I'm thinking about the extent to which the aesthetic can kind of shift the terrain of political concern. So I've used some Rancière for that, and also some Latour to think about how the aesthetic interacts with the political, because for the deep sea creatures, since they're not domesticated, they're not dogs, we don't live with jellyfish, we don't live with octopus, and they're not our close kin like primates, there are not that many avenues for fostering a kind of creaturely concern or environmental ethics or animal ethics toward those creatures. So I'm thinking about the aesthetic as really one of the few avenues of enticing or provoking a kind of environmentalism that would extend to the deep seas and the other pelagic or open ocean areas.
Stacey, thanks very much for your time. You've been extremely generous over multiple interviews with it. So I'm going to just ask you one final question. If you could tell me about one book that's influenced your thinking on the environment or your interest in environmental issues.
I think Donna Haraway's Primate Visions is quite the masterpiece. One of the things I admire about that book is that it was a very early book that focused on animal ethics, and which she doesn't use this term, but post-humanism or kind of critical post-humanism and animal studies. But it also at the same time focused attention on critiques of racism and sexism and colonialism, and she was able to juggle all of those things and just perform these very rich and illuminating multi-dimensional analyses within that text. The other thing about that book is that it was very early in the sense of being a new materialist work, in that she's very influenced and she uses post-structuralism, but she talks about not of peeling back the layers of the onion, but you still want to have something there. So it's a very, it's one of the first works, I think, that talks about wanting to retain the kind of incisive critique that post-structuralism, especially post-structuralist feminism or post-structuralist race studies, gave us, wanting to retain that kind of incisive critique, but then also have a sense of allowing material realities, the material world, and even for her, she talks about the animals helping to author the stories that she's telling. And so she has these kind of crossings methodologically that she's trying to emphasize there between the human and the non-human in terms of her methodology. And so I think that book was really important for me in my starting to think about new materialism and material feminism. But I also think it's a model work in terms of a kind of science studies and cultural studies and environmental studies in which she's doing so many things at once and juggling and balancing them all as they intersect.
Stacey, thanks so much for joining me on the show. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
That was my conversation with Stacey Alimo, professor of English at the University of Texas at Arlington. She's the author of Exposed, Environmental Politics and Pleasures in Post-Human Times. Thanks so much for joining me. I hope you'll listen in again next time.